Let's talk about fiber steering a little bit, which will kind of help you understand, help your listeners understand, I guess, how we leverage anisotropy. And so, because a carbon fiber is, best loaded in tension, or secondarily compression, but much better in tension. And, if you can align the fibers specifically to the load paths, along whether it's a panel or like a structure, then you end up with very interesting properties. Trying to get really to what we call iso strain, so meaning that the amount of stress or strain like within the part is equalized throughout the entirety of the part.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the Fabrication Friday podcast. I'm your host, Joe Fairley, certified prosthetist, 3D printing enthusiast, and owner of Ascent Fabrication. Fabrication Friday is an all-around fun time where I talk about 3D printing applications, conduct interviews with industry leaders, and much more. Come join us every Friday for an informational discussion around the evolution of the additive manufacturing field and how we utilize various digital workflows and 3D printing methods in our daily work at Ascent Fabrication.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Fabrication Friday podcast. If you didn't hear last week's episode, go back and tune in. Go back and tune in to the first 10, 20 episodes we have going on. They all kind of work off of one each other, and we're having some really interesting and unique conversations with people in the additive manufacturing industry. So definitely take a look at those past episodes. Today, I've got an awesome guest, Mr. Jacob Smith from Continuous Composites. He is an applications engineer there, and they are into the world of continuous carbon fiber printing, which has a whole world of its own I'm learning even more and more about. So thanks, Jacob, for coming on the podcast today. And would you mind telling us a little bit about your role there at Continuous Composites?
Yeah, thanks, Joe, for having me on. Yeah, as an application engineer, my role is essentially to find applications for the technology. And so I do a lot of research, a lot of development in terms of, I would say, not on a production level, but more on a research level, working with novel geometries, fiber architectures, just a little bit of everything, finding our sweet spot for the machines in the world of continuous carbon fiber.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few different ways to print carbon fiber nowadays. It seems there's some very specific printers that are out on the market to do so, and then a lot of carbon fiber blended materials, it seems, with some other polymers. But what is the kind of approach that you have at Continuous Composites to actually print these fibers?
Yeah, so something that makes our process unique is we take essentially a dry spool of carbon fiber, just single toe, 12K, and we run that through our head, and that goes into a fiber wet out module, which then takes a canister of resin and impregnates the fiber in situ in the head. And then that is then rolled out, compacted with a roller, and then hit with UV light. Okay. And then what that does is that gets us sort of a partial cure on that system. And so think of it like eggshell versus like a fully solid plastic. And so with that thermoset polymer, we partially stage that. And so that way we can continue to build upon that material and build very, very tall parts. Mm-hmm. I've seen parts built over 2-3 feet tall, like single toe, just wrapping around and building up. And so, and then after that is cured, then we go ahead, we take the part off of the machine and then put that in the oven and then cure that at a pretty low temperature. Doesn't need an inert environment or anything. And then go ahead and pull that out, and we have a finished part. And so from there, you might do some machining, post-operation, cutting, sampling, whatever you got to do. Mm-hmm. And then install that part into the assembly.
Sure. Yeah, so people don't really realize when, you know, you get into the more economy style 3D printing that, you know, there's a lot of post-processing that goes on with some of these prints. And when you're looking at these more industrial applications, like you're talking about, you know, there's quite a few steps there involved, right? So break it down maybe a little bit more for me. You've got the printing that's going on. Is that basically non-planar printing at that point, right?
Yeah, so we can do a little bit of everything, which in the industry, you know, 3D printing isn't really 3D printing, right? Because right. You're taking these 2.5D slices. I mean, you're making three-dimensional objects, of course, sure. But they don't really have, I guess you would say, the properties that you might be looking for. And so, you know, really everything in the world, you could call it anisotropic, which means that if you load it in one direction, it might behave slightly different than another. Mm-hmm. And so because of those slices, you end up, let's say you wanted to pull that part in tension, then that part is going to come apart much easier because of those layer lines and that bond between layers. And going from there into how do we design for anisotropy? How, you know, do we have to have a 3D mold that, you know, has some contours that form with a specific tool shape, you know, to fit within an assembly or a system? And, you know, with that, there's a lot of challenges getting into 3D, into true 3D. It's not just a simple slice and go.
Right.
You know, because now we're dealing with all of this curvature and then infinitely more data. And so that's something that, you know, I'm really proud of our software team for tackling that. They do an excellent job of mm-hmm. being able to produce something. You know, I would say our slicer, our system is not as like beautiful as, you know, some of these like popular 3D printing. Like if you buy a bamboo, you know, 3D printer and you're working with that, like everything's kind of polished. And kind of, I suppose, like the applications you're using it for are kind of set in stone. And sure. So our machines and our software work in such a way that you can design things for the anisotropic properties in a way that's like extremely powerful. And, you know, with that, we can get, for example, you know, like this wing behind me, this is a topology optimized wing. And so in carbon fiber, topology optimization, it just generally doesn't gel well with it because you might be dealing with, let's say, you're starting with a panel and then you need to machine that out, right? And then now you're severing all those fibers. And so with carbon fiber, you don't want to do that because, you know, you're going to lose a bunch of tensile and compression properties. You know, all your mechanicals are going to go down because of that. And so with the machine that allows you to, you know, move in three dimensions along, you know, a mold surface or something, and then also to steer, you know, left and right laterally along that surface, we can basically tailor the properties in a way that, you know, a lot of simulation hasn't even got there yet. And so this, you know, this anisotropy, so, you know, acting differently in different directions, it becomes a much more complex problem for manufacturing, for simulation, you know, just the entirety of the design loop system. And so kind of our aim is to, you know, develop that system, like how does design look like for like continuous fiber? You know, do you have to have, you know, an intersection? Like, mm-hmm. Here's an example of, you know, a part. It's just a cross, right? But this is a fully continuous fiber intersection.
Yeah.
And so it's actually, if you can see it, it is woven. And so, sure. You know, you have one toe going this way and then one toe going this way, back and forth. And that creates sort of this, interlaced structure. And so we can do a lot of interesting things with that and then create interesting properties. The reason this is important though, is because, you know, with 3D printing, topology optimization is, you know, a lot of your listeners probably are familiar with it. You know, how do we lightweight the material? You know, for prosthetics, even it's useful.
Yeah.
And especially when, you know, weight bears a huge factor for the patient, right? Because that's an extra pound or whatever that they're carrying around every day.
Sure.
Using that prosthetic. And the further we can, you know, optimize these systems, the more performance benefits we're going to have, you know, lightweight, strong. And, you know, with that, you have a lot of interesting challenges. You know, you end up with these structures that when they come out of the simulation, you know, the generative system, you look at that and you say, how in the heck am I going to make that? Right.
Right.
And yeah. Maybe with a 3D printer, you could at least slice it like this way and get kind of the general idea, but then it might not have the strength that the simulation is expecting it to have. Because typically with topology optimization, you just say, yep, the material is isotropic, so it acts the same in every direction. Let's just take little cubes and build up this material where it needs to go,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, get rid of the rest.
Right.
And you can't exactly do that because it's sort of a gross oversimplification of materials in general, besides maybe, you know, metallics and such. But even those, if you're doing an additive metal process, you're going to have those same layer lines where you'll have a limited amount of bonding between each layer. And so you still have to fight with that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is way beyond, you know, putting any design into PrusaSlicer or Cura, a, you know, more consumer level slicer program and optimizing, you know, just the print speed and printing temperature and cooling, right? You're not only creating, you know, the part itself, but it's the topology optimization and that, you know, again, designed for additive manufacturing technique to be able to interweave these fibers together in places that you need them. You know, being able to print in this non-planar way, I think, is a relatively newer concept, definitely for a few of my listeners, but just to understand, you know, that kind of aspect of things, you know, you're not just layering these carbon toes one after the other. You're actually laying one down, laying one over the top, and then laying another in a different direction over the top, and then going back over it. That's a lot more complicated of a process that, you know, I think, again, people don't realize just how much design process goes into not only the part itself, but then how do you slice it? How do you design that tool path? And then typically, probably you're going back and forth between that tool path and your design, maybe to optimize some of those design features to fit the tool path better, right?
Exactly. Yeah, there's so many aspects to that because commercially available software for like, to, let's say you start out with, you have your design space, right? So kind of think like for a wing, it might be a bounding box. That's the shape of the skin of the wing. And you say, okay, go play. And so you let the computer figure out where it wants to put material, et cetera. And then it spits out this blob that cannot be manufactured with the majority of practices. And then you have to, you know, you're kind of tinkering with that until you get to a stage where it makes sense. And then you might throw it back through simulation, do some FEA on it. And then now you have, you know, a somewhat validated model of what this thing should look like. You know, you kind of, you change that model to make it more manufacturable. And then you validated it. And so now you can maybe go into printing and, you know, see what happens. Do perhaps like a subsection of your final design, you know, load that mechanically, make sure it's checking out with your simulation that you're getting what you expect. And huge, huge challenge for the industry as a whole. And we're working with several companies right now to develop that. specifically for our manufacturing process. And so as it is a difficult challenge, you know, we want to kind of slicken the road a bit, you know, try to keep things moving, because, you know, if our customers don't know what they can even make with the product, right, and purchase it, and how they would make it, then, you know, what value is it, right? It's right. Just a cool six-axis robot.
Yeah. Which is cool on its own, right? I mean, there's things you can do with a robot, but you know, knowing what to do with it is half the battle.
Right. I mean, we could make tacos or burritos or something and, you know, make a little bit of money.
Sure.
I always talk about that with our controls team. Like, so when are we making a taco bot? That's what we really want.
I mean, there's enough AI jargon floating around now and some videos on social media about, you know, they're having cameras watching what people are doing so that the robot can then learn about what processes to do. And I'm wondering, in some respects, you know, where robotic 3D printing might be going if, you know, you have maybe a six-axis robotic arm learning from one of the FDM printers behind me and optimizing, you know, some of those tool paths again. So when you have a shape that you want to print, are you typically just kind of printing in midair then, because you are able to, you know, partially cure the part as it's printing, or are you physically printing on a bed surface, or otherwise do you print a shell of the part and you're printing over the top of some of those contours?
So yeah, we've experimented with a lot of different methods of, you know, creating this three-dimensionality. You know, starting from, you know, typically we have a build plate, you know, that will come with the machine. And so that would be for like a 2.5D stack, right? But if you want to do 3D, I mean, you can print material down and you can actually then, you know, you'd have to do a couple things, because you don't want the material to stick to itself in the sense of like the tool that you're making.
Yeah.
And so there's some things that you need to do just to make sure that it doesn't stick, you know, whether that's like a surface treatment between the two or something else. And typically we like to print with tools because we can get a, you know, higher composite quality out of that, because something to do with that pressure of the roller, the way that we're conditioning the fiber as it's kind of leaving the machine, we get, you know, much better, like fiber volume, for example, or void content is lower when we print along a tool surface. And so, and that tool can be made out of all kinds of things, right? Like we have a lot of aluminum we'll work with, you know, things like Ultem, even MDF actually makes a pretty decent tool, because, you know, our ovens don't have to be, you know, super, super hot. And so sure, as long as the glass transition temperature is higher than our oven temperature, then you could theoretically make a tool for that and then, you know, throw the whole thing in an oven. And so, you know, where the future goes, you know, I don't know. It could be a head change and we just pump out resin to make our tools, and then we go ahead and swap the head to our fiber placing head and then print down on that. And so, yeah, I kind of, as far as the printing process goes, you know, it, once the fiber is then, you know, commingled or infiltrated with the resin, that system, you know, super low oxygen content, like we're maintaining like no air bubbles in the system. That way we get a very consistent, you know, fiber, a TOA fiber coming out of that. And then that's then, you know, that goes through the roller. And then we have a small, what we call a post compactor. And so it's kind of like a little wiper that if there's any extra resin floating around there, it'll just kind of clean that up and disperse it off to the side. And
okay,
you have a more consistent, even toe with a high fiber volume and low void content.
Interesting. So yeah, you have to not only make sure that it's not going to stick to whatever tool that you're printing on for any type of support surface, right? Mm-hmm. But otherwise, you know, making sure that the again, the post-processing is still something I'm trying to wrap my mind around too. So if you have some parts that are, you know, say the size of an airplane wing, you know, then your oven has to be the size of an airplane wing, right?
Right.
So those are some hugely industrial ovens, like full rooms, the size of ovens that, so when you're trying to, I guess, assess maybe the right customer for you, you're really making sure that they have not only the specific part that would actually print well with your machine, but they have to have this whole ecosystem of equipment as well, right?
To a degree, yeah. I mean, depending on the part size, I mean, like in-house, we have probably a medium-sized oven, I would say. You know, it's nothing that you could like walk into or any of that. But, you know, if like, for example, this Wings bar behind me, this Wisdom project we did with the Air Force, they actually had that, you know, shipped out to a local vendor and had that essentially cured in the autoclave.
Okay.
Just, you know, because of the size and everything. And so, but however, I mean, we are working on other resin systems, other chemistries
sure.
that, you know, maybe are highly reactive with, you know, photo initiators so that they get a complete cure directly on the printer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's something that we're working toward. You know, nothing commercially available yet on that front, but, you know, we're always working with new resin systems. We actually partner with Arkema, and so they, you know, they're the chemists. They know way more than I do about their resin chemistry. I just try to follow along on coattails to understand, you know, what's happening.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah.
So with the, you said you're printing 12K tow carbon
yeah.
fiber. And so are you printing multiple different tows? How does the material kind of vary over the different parts that you want to print? And is it only carbon fiber, or are you printing fiberglass or something else?
Yeah. So yeah, we print all kinds of materials. We've been doing a lot of experimentation with glass, and not to say that, you know, we don't support that. We're working on that. We have that completely, you know, that's something that we deliver to customers. And, you know, that's an entire system that's kind of been locked down. We have parameters for it. Can use the same resin that we use with carbon fiber as with glass.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the interesting okay. thing about working with glass is that, you know, you have that optical transparency. And so the degree of cure that you get off the printer is a lot higher because, you know,
okay.
it's transparent. So it's, you know, while glass does absorb some UV light, you know, not nearly as much as black carbon fiber.
Right, right. Yeah, that's
and so
interesting.
We get parts that are they're pretty stiff actually right off the printer, and then we still bake those just to ensure that the you know, everything is completely cured.
Okay, so then what's kind of the a typical comparison, I guess, to the amount of print time and maybe post-processing time that it takes to print out a part like that? You know, I know printing in an airplane wing versus printing a, say, a prosthetic socket or another small widget within a 200 millimeter cube is quite different in time, but how does that time vary?
Well, I mean, if you're only printing, let's say, like a coupon, you know, something to test with, could be just a few hours. And so we print everything that, you know, could take 2 hours or 1 hour. Like this intersection is about, I would say, an hour.
Okay.
So all the way up to, you know, 4 weeks, depending on the size.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 4 weeks is a bit past my longest time of about 62 hours, I think is my longest, but
okay.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. You know, when we talk about some of these lead times too, for some of these parts that, you know, are there some benefits to that where you have maybe a really long lead time like that, but maybe are those particular parts do they have longer lead times for traditional manufacturing, or are you otherwise just providing some kind of geometry that can't be manufactured in that way?
Right. So, I mean, there's a lot of aspects to that. And so when, for example, I mean, the wing spar is an excellent kind of, you know, idea to go off of, because traditional wing spars, you know, you might have 50, 100 parts in an assembly, and then you have your riveting, your bonding, you know, there's all these different steps, and you have to machine, you know, every part individually. They all have their own tools. And when you have something like this wing here, this topology optimized wing, you get both the topology optimization. So, you know, that structure is going to be more efficient, strength to weight. And also, you know, you have this unitized system where this would otherwise be, you know, potentially 50 parts. Little riblet, the spar itself, all the brackets in between. And so really you can see a lot of cost savings. And imagine the tooling that you have to have just to put the riblet into place. You know, that's a tool right there. And then you have another tool for the next riblet. And so it can really stack up, and there's a lot of opportunity for mistakes. And so, you know, our company, we strive to unitize everything as much as possible. And so the more we can get out of that, what would be an assembly, into a single part, the better. While it might require, for example, like a larger machine bed, you know, to then post-process it, et cetera, you know, those systems are becoming so prevalent today, you know, with these five-axis routers that are commonly available. And then you take this spar and you just, you know, put adhesive where it needs to go, bond it into the skin, and put some weight on it, possibly walk away.
Right.
It's the process. And so we're removing a lot of the human labor out of it, along with the performance benefits.
I've been trying to eliminate some of the human labor parts of the manufacturing process, I think, are one of the biggest benefits of 3D printing in general, right? If you can have otherwise someone monitoring several machines, or, you know, a couple people monitoring maybe a larger machine like you've got, versus an assembly line process, right, of putting together one of these, you know, huge airplane wings, I'm sure that cuts down on not only the cost of the part, but just all the other costs associated with that, with having the employees, you know, healthcare costs and other type of, you know, downtime costs. It's an interesting way to think about it that, again, really you only get into if you're doing this more industrial 3D printing, you know, on a much larger scale. So, you know, can you talk about a little bit of, other than like an airplane wing, what are some other applications that you guys are looking into right now?
Yeah, my brain is super focused on aerospace because, you know, that is a lot of our customers. Sure. However, you know, like prosthetics are a great example of something that would behoove our process, due to the, you know, there's a lot of three-dimensional contours happening locally in that process. And then you have, if you're to make that out of a traditional carbon fiber, you know, you'll have your mold, which won't be dissimilar to what we would have to do. You know, you have a mandrel or something, a form to then print onto to get all of those shapes. But our system, I mean, with the steering, that completely washes away any of the issues in a lot of cases, where you have problems with carbon fiber when you do like hand layup, for example, where, you know, if you need to go around this three-dimensional contour, imagine trying to place a piece of paper over that contour. It's going to wrinkle, it's going to fold and do all these things. And you're actually going to reduce your strength with that. And so, you know, fiber buckling is a big no-no in the industry. And, you know, huge knockdowns in strength, of course. And, you know, our system, because it lays down a single toe at a time, that while it might take a little longer than like an AFP machine, we can get into details that that other systems just can't, they can't do.
Right.
And so, you know, if you have, let's just say a combination, you're probably really familiar with like concave, convex, sorts of like dual curvature geometries.
Sure.
Yeah. Probably pretty prevalent in prosthetics.
And yeah, any kind of, you know, just organic limb shape definitely has all those curves to it.
Right. And then every time you go over one, then your fabric would then pleat, wrinkle, and
I'm thinking back now to my traditional technical days when I was a prosthetic technician and doing some of these, you know, wet lamb carbon fiber layups of I believe it was 6K toe, somewhere around there, 4K or 6K. And, you know, there's plenty of times where that, you know, carbon fiber tube braid would either, you know, fold over on itself, or then you're really just doing this manual process of, integrating resin into this vacuum form bag over a prosthetic limb shape. And then trying to somewhat evenly distribute this resin throughout the entire prosthetic socket, which, you know, it's more of an art form than a science, I would think. And, you know, there's a lot of hands-on parts of it that could go wrong in that process and just create more of a dissimilar, you know, uneven amount of resin throughout the entire prosthetic socket. So having an opportunity to more uniformly distribute, those, not only the fibers, but the, you know, having the impregnated resin right in there, I could definitely see being a benefit to the prosthetic industry if the cost of it weren't, abnormally too high for, you know, this type of application. There's definitely, I think, a use case for it if we can come up with, you know, some type of geometry or prosthetic socket design that couldn't be otherwise traditionally manufactured and there was some benefit for the patient. But have you had any feedback from other people on that yet?
So, yeah, as far as those geometries, I guess in terms of like prosthetics, you know, that wasn't something that we really have considered a whole lot until I think it was John, who you've been speaking to, is kind of how this all happened.
Right.
He comes from the medical world, and as he came on, you know, in the software side, and some of his demonstrations were more prosthetics focused because, you know, a lot of difficult geometry going on. And
yeah,
I sort of thought to myself, like, okay, like maybe, but you know, you must have a bias because you're from the medical industry. And then after I really gave it some thought, I was like, hold on, there's actually huge potential for this, especially if you need that high performance and, you know, you can't afford to have, when you're doing hand layup with prosthetics, do you typically have like laser cut sections then that you would place, you know, using a laser guiding system, or how exactly would you fabricate that? More of like an artistic cut and trim and fill? And
it's definitely a bit more artistic and cut and trim and fill for sure. People have a couple different ways to go about it. There are the just carbon fiber tubes that we just otherwise, you know, one size fits most kind of mentality. And those fibers get spread out more or less depending on how large that limb shape is. And you might have different diameters of the of those tubes of carbon fiber, which we also introduce some fiberglass and some other synthetic materials within the whole layup itself. But that's kind of the interesting thing about our field, is that there's no real standards in how we're actually manufacturing these sockets. So it's really just up to the person doing it to figure out, okay, am I only going to be using these tubes, or do I otherwise cut out some you know, vertical, you know, rectangular sections to otherwise place over? There's I don't know why I'm blanking on this at the moment, but the other carbon fiber layup format that we would use does have more of the, you know, cut and paste rather.
Prepreg, maybe?
Prepreg, thank you.
Yeah, there you go.
Word was a little bit later in the day here and working through it, but, you know, prepreg is a little bit more, I guess, newer to our field. Maybe not so new in the concept, but newly applied to just having more knowledge about how to lay up prepreg for prosthetic sockets. And it's actually taken off more for lower extremity orthotics as well, where we have, you know, these posterior leaf spring AFOs, ankle foot orthosis, where you have kind of a cuff section over the calf and then this spiralized, you know, rectangular shape coming down the back of the leg down to a carbon fiber foot plate. So there we have a lot of, you know, singular cut and paste, and then not only laying up, but it's already pre-impregnated with the resin and then oven cured under vacuum afterwards. So there's those couple different ways to do that traditional approach. And again, it's really just up to the technician having that experience of, you know, doing those hundreds and hundreds of layups or learning from someone who has done that in order to gain that knowledge of how to best put that carbon fiber. And honestly, it's an over-engineered thing in our field. You know, they're really, like I said, there aren't any standards of how much carbon fiber should be in a prosthetic socket. And that's a big point of debate in our field. So, you know, you're really just learning from the person that did it last. And, you know, that's what's so cool now about 3D printing coming on the scene of, okay, now we can specifically take a look at maybe a subset of these limb shapes. Maybe it's just, you know, put them in the whole can of below the knee and an above the knee prosthetic socket. And those different limb shapes, maybe we can come up with optimized tool paths specifically to orient the fibers in a way that are, you know, optimizing those forces that the socket sees on it. I think is a huge advantage to using 3D printing. And now only if we can make sure that it gets implemented in a way that financially makes sense.
Right. No, exactly. And depending on the process, the bit that I understand about prosthetics and carbon fiber, it'd be really interesting to, you know, kind of do a costing analysis and understand, because either way, you're going to have a tool. And so whether you're doing a hand layup or prepreg or printing on it, you know, with a CF3D system, then you're in a situation. So you have that tool, and now does the print time make sense versus the hand layup time? You know, how fast can you turn around a tool? And so could you do that tool out of an additive process to make sure that it's hitting the geometry it needs to for this custom, you know, the one-off patient, and then going down the line all the way through the baking process. And I think, you know, because of, let's talk about fiber steering a little bit, which will kind of help you understand, help your listeners understand, I guess, how we leverage anisotropy. And so, you know, because a carbon fiber is, you know, best loaded in tension or secondarily compression, but much better in tension. And, you know, if you can align the fibers specifically to the load paths along, whether it's a panel or like a structure, then you end up with, you know, very interesting properties, you know, trying to get really to what we call iso strain. So meaning that, you know, the amount of stress or strain like within the part is equalized throughout the entirety of the part. And so no hot spots, right? When you see those heat maps of your three-dimensional parts,
right?
We don't want to see any of those hot spots. And so when we do that, you end up needing, you know, far less material. And so you can make those parts thinner, lighter, and they also look really cool.
I'm sure.
Imagine like a more like a river where things are kind of flowing around where they need to. And
yeah,
and it's almost like carbon fiber plus wood. You know, if you have, imagine sure. like a standard board, you have a knot, and then the fibers are guiding around that knot.
Sure.
And so we can do the same thing with carbon fiber now.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about, because, you know, with the how we're designing prosthetic sockets right now, well, let's say from a traditional standpoint, you have the entire surface area of that limb shape is covered with carbon fiber, right? And we're otherwise, after the fact, only trimming out what we call a trim lines that are around, you know, the patient's anatomy to a point where it's not going to impede their function or, you know, their motion of their limb, otherwise offering some structural support to their bony anatomy. But then, you know, in some ways we actually pinpoint these areas to lightweight the socket, whether we're cutting out windows after the fact. So a very wasteful process, right? But if we can, you know, otherwise print these, you know, flowing structures in the path of force. Yeah, I mean, to me, it makes complete sense.
Yeah, it's such a new field, and there's so many just interesting dynamics to it. When I first jumped on with the company back in 2022, so I had no idea what fiber steering was yet, and you know, my supervisor had me start reading the literature, you know, that's on things like fiber steering optimization and, you know, what people are doing with that. And it was just so fascinating to start to learn it. And yeah, we are really very wasteful with our carbon fiber products. Because like you said, if you want to, you know, cut out a hole in some area because you don't really need the strength there.
Right.
And realistically, that should be either a variable thickness part, you know, so that skin that's around that mold or that limb is going to, if you were to optimize it to the theoretical perfection, you'd have these kind of gradients, right? But in manufacturing, gradients they don't work. Because we need to like cut this out here, and we don't want to waste a bunch of time putting a fillet or a chamfer on it because it costs too much. And that's kind of the beauty of additive, right? Is that we can just print the fillets in, you know, print these features in to get what we want.
Right.
And so with fiber steering, you're also changing the load paths. Because if you redirect it, you know, you're kind of fighting with that river, that flow of stress, but also you might be able to redirect it in an interesting way. And, you know, that's something that people have just scraping the surface of what's possible with that. And so as we go down to the smaller scale, let's say, I mean, we print with a 12K fiber right now, yeah. Which is about 3 millimeters or about, whatever that is that an eighth of an inch? No,
I can only think in millimeters as well, something like that. Not an eighth of an inch.
I came from Imperial, and then they got me switched over to metric here.
Yep,
and I can't go back.
Yeah, no, you can't. If the weird thing is though, my brain can think in like spans of height in inches, but then any circumference or smaller increment has to be millimeters. yeah, it's a weird thing in the prosthetics orthotics industry too. We do a lot of circumferences in metric and then heights in imperial for some reason. But They can't just pick one or the other. They have to use both.
Terrible. Mixed units.
Oh, man.
But anyways, so, you know, we're printing with 12K right now, but, you know, we have design targets. We'd love to print with 3K or 24K, you know, going up or down in scale. And that's just a matter of parameterizing the system. What kind of values do we use for like UV light? How much force do we compact the fiber with? And it might require different hardware as well. And so, but as we change scale, then I think some really interesting things will happen because you'll be, as you know, like 12K, you can steer it quite well. But at a certain point, it starts to like buckle the fibers. And so they'll start wrinkling, like the inside will kind of pucker and try to like lift up because of that compression.
Sure.
And then the outside is totally tight, right? And so you get higher like void content. And then, but as you go down in that width of that ribbon, then you can steer tighter and tighter and really align to the intended load paths.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to take a look at. If you could otherwise have a multi-tool head that could have different toe on it at one time to be able to get those smaller sections with a smaller toe. I'm thinking about the other applications, you know, for what carbon fiber is used in the world today. Race car bodies or bicycles as well. Do you see any of your customers looking at those applications as well, or has the aerospace been, you know, more of the primary focus so far?
Well, we've kind of had to hold the door closed with people trying to batter it down on that aspect. We've been approached by various companies in those spaces and say, not right now. We're busy.
Yeah. No, I think that's great though. You know, if it's the burden of opportunity, you know, not spreading yourself out too thin, but making sure that you have the tool paths and process down is definitely something to work for. Again, we have the burden of choice here with just regular FDM printing. You can practically print anything, you know, that you would want in a on a much less industrial scale than the type of printing you're doing there. But interesting to hear that you've had, you know, some of these other people reach out and try to apply this, because again, with the non-planar approach that you have going on with the robotic axis, I think that's just opens so many doors to being able to produce larger objects too.
Right. Yeah. And we actually, forget when it was. It was last fall. We released a seventh axis rotator, and so, you know, perfect application for something like a prosthetic. Because before we were working with a locating table, as we call it, and so you can place, you know, three dimensional molds, all kinds of things on that table. But at some point, you are limited by like robot reach. For example, if you had a pedestal that had your prosthetic mold, you know, just standing up on end like this, and it could get around to a degree, but then at some point getting that continuous fiber to totally wrap is really difficult and requires, you know, potentially additional axes. And so we released that rotator, and now we've really opened up the doors for new relevant geometries to our space, and, you know, more unitization of these assemblies into single parts.
Yeah, that's pretty neat too. With I didn't quite think about that. If you've got that reach of the robot going around to a specific point, you know, you see Z seams in regular FDM printing. You definitely don't want to see a Z seam or any type of seam in this more industrial approach, I'm sure. And then otherwise, you're just compromising some of that strength that you're trying to achieve in that, right? So with the couple different industries that you guys are focusing on right now. You know, where do you kind of see this leading for? Is it is there any approach to any kind of maybe not consumer type? I wouldn't say like a pure desktop printer in this way. You know, I know there's a couple other competitors out there, right? There's Markforged. There's a newer company on the scene too that does a slightly different type of printing, Impossible Objects. They're also doing some carbon fiber, you know, laying down of sheets, which is still yet another different type of printing, I think, potentially here. But, you know, where do you see this leading into other applications for not just, you know, aerospace level companies?
Yeah, so the whole space is fascinating because everyone really is trying to go for the same things, I think, which would be, you know, the continuous fiber, steering that fiber into those load paths, as well as the non-planar geometry. And so those are all really, really hard problems for the industry. And, you know, some going with a larger scale aerospace, you know, you have companies like Electro Impact who make AFP machines. And so those machines are similar to ours in the sense that they're, you know, laying down the fiber. They have a roller, you know, six axis robot, the head, everything's happening, but, you know, they're focused on much larger payouts. And so they can make a wing for, let's say, a Boeing 737 and then do it pretty fast because you're dealing with tapes that are super wide. And then going from that, all the way down to like a Markforged or, you know, Impossible Objects, you got Orbital.
There's a Miso print as well.
What was that?
A Miso print.
A Miso. I think I've heard that recently. I haven't checked them out.
I might be butchering the name there a little bit, but Anisio print or Aniso print. I think they're also doing some continuous fiber printing that is very similar, I think, to the Markforged approach of the FDM style. But yeah, that'd be another company that comes to mind that's in a similar space, but on a little bit of a different scale, I think, than what you guys are approaching.
Yeah, and you know, with the recent lawsuit, there was a judgment that happened the other week with Markforged. You know, we won, so I am just ecstatic at the space that we have carved out for ourselves. You know, if we want to get into, you know, a desktop system, we would be, it's totally possible. We don't have all of the other, you know, the entire industry essentially is going after this right now.
Right.
Because the properties you can get from, you know, steered materials is incredible. And, you know, that's an entire space. And so when I joined the company, I was thinking to myself, there's no way these guys are going to be able to kind of keep the dam held against this entire way of thinking with additive. But yeah, so when we have the space carved out and, you know, we're really excited to develop in it, you know, potentially royalties with other companies trying to work in the same space that want to use our technology. And I'm just really excited to see where it goes. I think the desktop system is going to be really, really pivotal in sort of garnishing an understanding of additive and isotropic materials as a whole, because they're really, really valuable in so many ways that we're just kind of scratching the surface, like I was saying before, about how you can use this stuff. And whether that's a, you know, a suspension system for an F1, or, you know, prosthetic, or a rocket, like all right. of these things, you know, become infinitely more possible. And, you know, we're gonna be decreasing the weight considerably on all these systems and unitizing them as well. And so you're gonna probably see a lot of really interesting geometries that don't make a lot of sense in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years. But they work.
Yeah, that's you use the term unitizing, and I think that's something that shouldn't be taken lightly too here and looked over, because back to your point of maybe an entire airplane wing being into these separate components that have to be assembled together, but then otherwise being able to print those all of those parts into one piece, I think, you know, having that freedom of coming up with newer geometries and other ways to, you know, just reduce the amount of material we're using in some of these parts is super interesting and really cool to see that, you know, progression of how we're actually designing some of these things to be used in industrial purposes. You know, when it comes to prosthetics, it's a finicky thing, honestly, because of the insurance, reimbursement that we're kind of tied to for some of the cost of some of these devices. You know, looking at what it would cost to do something from the traditional manufacturing approach to bringing in one of these 3D printers in-house is definitely a huge point of contention right now in the field for the prosthetics industry, for sure. You know, and orthotics for that matter. But I think there's a lot of ways that we can, you know, again, think outside the box to otherwise produce very hard to make shapes, you know, that could be delivered in a similar approach. And yeah, you know, speaking about patents and infringements and everything like that, I know the space is a very quickly evolving one, and there's definitely a little bit of competition brewing. And it's interesting to see the outcome of that result, you know, because I've known about Mark Forged for a lot longer than I've heard of continuous composites. But, you know, I think there's a lot of still some good stuff that can come out of, you know, what that, you know, how that finalized with that a case. And I think there's maybe, the couple different ways they could probably move forward in a way that wouldn't be, you know, so non-mutual. You know, maybe there's some way that y'all can work together to produce something even better. But, you know, I think there's, again, some opportunity to just think outside the box with how we're approaching some of these geometries. And I'm excited to see, you know, what you guys come up with.
Yeah. And we definitely don't want to, you know, stifle the industry in any way by trying to hoard the IP, not let anyone do anything. You know, we're always open to, you know, leasing that out for royalties.
Yeah. Not to mention the FTC just banned all non-competes, and we'll see what happens after that. Did you hear about that hearing yesterday?
No, I didn't.
Oh yeah. That was it's an interesting space right now in the in the business realm. Yeah, the FTC just completely banned non-competes for non-C-level executives. There's a lot more to it for those of you that want to, you know, look into exactly what that entailed. But there was something about the C-level executives in the future not having some non-competes. And I think it wraps right into what we mentioned about patents and infringement and, you know, some innovation being stifled or not stifled. You know, I think having patents is it's a double-edged sword, right? You want to protect the work that you're working on, and, you know, rightfully so with maybe some non-competes in the past too, you know, but driving innovation can happen, you know, internally and in due course with, you know, patent protection and making sure that, you know, there is that internal IP that is worth something to, you know, the company overall, I think. And yeah, it's just an interesting environment, I think, that we're in right now with some of these things happening.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that, you know, our technology has been around since 2011, 2012. Our first provisional was in 2012. And, you know, this guy making glass fiber boats, he cut himself and was like, why do we have to do it like this? And so he came with the idea how you could, you know, use these UV curable resins and roll it out, you know, hit it with UV light, you know, cure it in situ and not have to cut himself on the glass.
Right.
And so, but I still find myself picking carbon fiber out of my fingers just about every day. So
do you? Okay. Okay. That was going to be one of my other questions, was how dirty is this approach?
No. I mean, just, you know, some post-processing and such, but, you know, carbon fiber is really, it's egregious. It gets everywhere. And so when you do cut it, it's better to cut it wet. If you can't, you know, you want to have vacuum and filtration and all kinds of stuff to protect yourself. But
I wish I knew that going into the prosthetics orthotics industry back in 2016, 2017, when I was a technician. And, you know, back then there was just some, you know, levels of PPE weren't as much of a concern for, you know, the technicians who had been doing it already for 40, 50 years. And, you know, so the vacuum filtration, air filtration, any kind of, you know, mask, you just didn't find it. You know, so yeah, now when I print with any carbon fiber polymer blended material too, and we do some cutting and grinding, you know, post-processing of some of these prints, you know, trying to stay as protected as possible, obviously, is a good thing. And it's interesting to hear that, you know, a printing process like this came out of, you know, some guy not wanting to be cut by some of this material. I think that all good things kind of come out of an approach of, can we do this thing better, right?
That's how it would
be the thought process.
Right. It's, you know, as a whole, you know, that industry is like, I don't even think the original founders understood what they were starting.
Right.
You know, like, this is it's a big thing. And there's so many advantages to being able to have that single, like, toe precision. You know, when you place that toe, then you can create things like weeds. And so I'll show you this here. So this is something that we came up with recently. So it sort of resembles your traditional, you know, fabric, but, you know, that's actually made because we can print a single toe at a time. And, you know, what we call that, I mean, we've gone over this internally so much, but I think we're starting to settle on selective fiber placement.
Okay.
So no one's really doing this, as far as I know, in-house. You know, I think it kind of all was spurned off of, you know, things like intersections where, you know, you're placing one toe one direction and another the other direction.
Right.
And it took us a little while to realize that you can analyze this. You can actually continue, create a pattern. You know, for example, if you're making a prosthetic and you want some damage tolerance, for example, you could custom tailor, you know, sort of a weave on the outside of that part to actually create impact resistance.
Right.
So, you know, unidirectional carbon fiber is the strongest, because if we're steering that exactly where the load paths are, you know, it works really, really well in that one direction. But then as soon as something else happens, like, let's say it's designed perfectly for loading a human standing on this device. But what if they hit their knee on something? Then all that strength is not designed for that particular impact. And so then you can essentially, you know, maybe put a single layer on the outside of this sort of woven structure, and then kind of get some of those like quasi-isotropic, like, you know, relatively predictable failure modes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
a tangent, but
yeah, no, that's a great tangent. I'm glad that you showed that part. And if anyone is only listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts right now, you definitely need to hop over to the YouTube, you know, video section of this and check out those parts that Jacob just showed. Having something panelized like that, that opens up a whole nother realm of strength opportunities, especially in controlled zones, right? Of going from a unidirectional, controlling the fiber path in one section, but then otherwise, having those panels of overlapped fibers. Possibilities are endless there, right?
Right. And it's tough to wrap your head around at first because, you think of, generally people think in pretty separate terms of, you have a fuselage or a panel, right? You have this shape, it's flat, whatever. And then you have like a structure. And so you think of like a house, same thing. You have your roof, you have your walls, and you have your beams. And I think the future really lies in the space in between those. So maybe a panel turns into a beam, right? So in one area you need this, and then another you have that same continuous fiber that's then transforming from that panel into a beam and then back into a panel, or some mix of the two as well. Like if you have like an iso grid stiffened structure, like on this side, this is panelized, but on this side we have an iso grid.
Yeah, sure.
And so, having that variable stiffness, variable part thickness, having that level of granularity, I think that's where the future's at.
For sure. Yeah, that's and possibilities are endless with the toolpath optimization and design process that you can go through for, that type of printing. And I'm really glad that that my listeners here get to experience some of this, more interesting, thought-provoking ways of thinking about how parts can be made, not just in the prosthetics or orthotics industry and in several other industries as well. Anyone that's using carbon fiber should, definitely look into, what you guys are up to over there. With the aerospace aspect of this, they're talking about how, you got SpaceX trying to go out to either the moon or to Mars, and what type of ships are going to be 3D printed in the near future. That, we've seen a lot of metal printing happening, but, what of the other, maybe inside components that could be otherwise carbon fiber printed, that would, and where, where do those parts end up? And, what do those parts look like over their lifetime? And how do you service those parts? And then, do you make them modular? Do you make it all one continuous piece? You mentioned, house structures. With 3D printing concrete now, again, these possibilities of additive manufacturing are honestly seemingly endless. And it's just a really cool, opportunity to take a look at, what's happening on the continuous fiber path.
Yeah. I'm so excited for the future because, a lot of companies, it seems that they, in the additive space, a lot of people are kind of headed toward that space direction where, we're going to need to have additive in the case of situations of, we're in space, we need a part right now. How do we get it? Yeah. And something that we've set up from the beginning, it kind of puts us ahead of prepregs and, other systems, is because like a prepreg, you actually have to store those at refrigeration temperatures or freezing temperatures.
Right.
Otherwise, the material will actually cure. And so if you have a separated system, let's say you have a canister of resin and you have a spool of fiber, you can ship boxes and boxes of this stuff. It doesn't have to be these, specially processed rolls or anything. It's like, no, fiber, resin, let's make something. And so I think, the future... future of additive, going to space, needing that sort of flexibility of manufacturing practices, You know, if you put one of our machines in a room with an oven and a CNC mill, like you can do just about anything.
Yeah.
And so it's an exciting time for us, exciting time for just the space as a whole. I think we're going to need more and more stuff like this to, you know, get to Mars, for example. And by the side tangent, I had no interest in space as a kid. Like I thought it was okay. It was like, whatever, but I loved making stuff and, you know, ended up becoming a mechanical engineer. And then I think it was Elon Musk who actually got me interested in space, because he put probably the best way, the best reason why we need to be, you know, on Mars and on other planets terraforming is because we need to be a multiplanetary species in case something happens. Like we have to protect
us. Yeah.
And so, you know, agree with Elon's general points of view or not. I think that's a really good point. I think that we need to have that kind of redundancy and keep pushing the envelope into space exploration, into, you know, all these different kind of first principle ways of thinking about life and like where we need to go with technology.
Yeah, that's it's a lot to unpack there. And I think there's, again, we've hit on so many different possibilities with the continuous fiber printing. I think it's going to leave quite a few people wondering what's next, you know, for you guys, and then what else is possible out there on a large or small scale, in whatever field we're into. But thank you very much for, you know, taking the time to chat with me today, you know, and giving us some background on what you guys are up to. You know, is there anything else that you'd like the listeners to know here? And you know, if, I know you said your doors are kind of closed and you're shooing people away for the time being, but
yeah,
you know, if they want to look up some information, you know, other than the website, what can they do there?
Yeah, so we're on LinkedIn, we're on the socials. I couldn't tell you the exact titles for those, but you can find us around town. Quarterly in Idaho, continuouscomposites.com, I believe. And I'm very excited for where this goes. I hope that your listeners will keep tabs on us and, you know, see some of the public projects that we have going on.
For sure. Yeah. Are you guys going to be at Rapid TCT this year down in LA?
I believe so.
Awesome. Well, yeah, well, I'll see you there then. I'll be out there for Black Belt, the continuous conveyor belt printer. You know, pretty interesting printer on its own as well. But yeah, very cool, Jacob. Thank you very much for taking the time with us today. To our listeners, you know, again, if you guys are more interested in some topics that you think I should cover, please feel free to reach out. If you'd like to be a guest on the podcast as well, feel free to reach out anytime for consideration. And otherwise, please rate and review the podcast and share this with someone that you think would benefit from it. So thanks again, Jacob. Appreciate the time you spent with us today. And for everyone else, happy printing.